You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton,
and I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are joined to you today, is has become tradition at the end of the Seahawks season, by friend of the pod, third Pelton brother extraordinaire, Ben Baldwin of The Athletic Seattle, to help us unwrap what everything that just happened and what's going to happen going forward.
Thanks for having me. It's a little bit earlier than in the past couple of years, but I'm sure we will get to that.
I mean, I think this is the third year in a row we've done it, or it could be four. Either way, it would not be the earliest. So,
yeah, you know. That's fair. Of the 4 years we've done it, this is actually tied for second longest.
Technically, they played later on Saturday night in 2018, so that was the difference, because there wasn't yet six playoff games on Super Wild Card Weekend. There wasn't yet the excitement that was the Nickelodeon broadcast. So the Seahawks lost to the LA Rams 30-20 on Saturday. It maybe wasn't as close as the final score indicated. I mean, there were kind of garbage time touchdowns on both sides. The Robert Woods touchdown to make it a 17-point game, and then the Seahawks getting their lone second half touchdown late. Tristan, you were very optimistic when we last recorded this podcast, although you became gradually less optimistic over the week that happened that passed. What didn't happen that you expected?
Offense. I do think part of it is it's really frustrating that the Wolford question went unanswered. I mean, you know, they had a bit of a drive before he got injured, but nothing that I saw yesterday makes me think that John Wolford is definitively better than Jared Goff. And I think, unfortunately, you know, maybe dissimilar to last season's first round playoff game against the Eagles, the Seahawks probably ended up facing the better quarterback yesterday in Jared Goff instead of John Wolford. And I'm not sure if the game plan that the Rams had with Wolford would have been a successful game plan against the Seahawks defense. The other piece that I definitely did not know when we were having that conversation earlier in the week was about the return of Andrew Whitworth. And I think that the Rams offensive line really dominated the Seahawks in a lot of ways throughout that game and allowed the Rams to be able to do some things that they weren't necessarily able to do in the second half of the season. Whether we just want to give credit to Whitworth for that remains to be seen, or whether they were strictly outcoached or whatever. But the Rams offense, even though Goff didn't have a good game, this wasn't Cam Akers 21 carries for 34 yards. You know, like there was a massive difference between the Rams offense that we saw in week 17 against the Cardinals and the Rams offense that we saw in what was week 18 against the Seahawks. And I think those two pieces, I mean, the recovery that Whitworth made, look, if we were looking at this objectively and not from a Seahawks perspective, it would be impressive that he came back and made this recovery to play in what may be his final playoff game. As a Seahawks fan, it fucking sucks, because we thought we approached the situation as if he wasn't going to be there. And this is still a legendary offensive lineman and the core of that group for the Rams. And I think seeing that, seeing the recoveries that everybody was making throughout the week, my confidence kind of waned. And it all leading to the moment that Goff came in, and it was like, we know what's going to happen here. You know, Sean McVay made the move to, and he let everybody know that they could have played Jared Goff and he chose to start John Wolford. And the second that Goff came in, I was like, this game is over. The Seahawks cannot win this.
You knew that he was going to come in and complete nearly half his pass attempts.
That's funny, because that was basically the exact opposite of my reaction. So I thought, and I guess this is kind of the same discussion that you guys already had on the last podcast, but I thought Wolford gave the Rams the best chance of beating the Seahawks. And once Jared Goff came in with his broken finger, I was like, oh, I think the Seahawks probably have a really good chance now. And that obviously isn't what happened. And like, even though we're talking about the Seahawks defense and the Rams scoring points, like 30 points looks bad, but there was seven of them on a pick six and then seven more after a muffed punt, I think it was. And like, those plays didn't really have anything to do with the defense and make the final points allowed look pretty bad. But I think the real story of the game is just Seattle's offense looking like a disaster throughout the whole game.
Yeah, I mean, the Rams had negative EPA per play in this game. Jared Goff, like I said, completed 9 of 19 passes. They went for 155 yards, but that was, you know, largely on a couple of big plays in this game. In particular, the deep ball to Cooper Kupp that Jamal Adams was unable to make a play on. And you take those away, and there were a lot of three and outs, a lot of short drives for the Rams, and the Seahawks offense was utterly incapable of taking advantage of them. And this wasn't a situation like the Cowboys game in 2018. I don't know whether it's better or worse, but it wasn't, you know, oh, the Seahawks were running, passing the ball really well, and they just refused to do it. Like, they tried to pass sometimes. They had zero ability to do it, even when the Rams were short Aaron Donald for most of the second half of this game.
Yeah, and I think we'll get into, like, exactly what is wrong with the offense. But, like, one of the stories that I was telling myself beforehand is maybe they just can't block Aaron Donald and Russell Wilson is spooked whenever Aaron Donald's on the field. But then they played almost an entire half without Aaron Donald and the offense still looked terrible. So it's hard to, like, point to that as being the factor for why the Seahawks just can't play football against the Rams.
Pass rush is definitely still good without Aaron Donald, but yes, I mean, yep. There are a couple things that we learn in that game, and you know, it feels like Aaron Donald is just Russell Wilson kryptonite, and maybe it's not strictly Aaron Donald, maybe it's just this Rams defensive line in general is Russell Wilson kryptonite, or maybe the second half of the season was, and we'll definitely talk about that more. But you know, I feel like I come back to a couple of plays where it's like, and this wouldn't have changed anything long term, the offense is still broken. The ball that they missed, which Aaron Donald did disrupt, to DK, that if Russ hits it 3 yards shorter, I mean, we're talking about a totally different game if that play is any different. And there are just a couple of those moments where it's like, they missed it by an inch, or, you know, not going for it after the false start penalty. You know, the game wasn't necessarily within reach at that point. Maybe weren't feeling confident that they were going to score, but they might have stayed on the field. Pete choosing to kick field goals early on in the game, you know, when they did have opportunities, not maximizing those opportunities. And look, the offense played bad, but I think they were put in a pretty bad position throughout the game. And you know, it's still ultimately could have been one or two plays could have changed everything. And I think that's what's so frustrating about it is like, those things have happened for us, you know, for the Seahawks, those one or two things that can happen have happened, and they've eked out a lot of these victories. And yesterday they didn't. And I think that's why everybody was a little bit shocked after the game. You know, maybe they took this one for granted. You know, I think also the Seahawks, they played what is probably, let me do some math here, maybe the third best team in the NFC in that game, you know, fully equipped Rams. It's a conversation.
But they weren't fully equipped. That's the whole point. You keep saying this.
The Rams are a good team. The Bears are not a good team. Washington is not a good team. And the Seahawks had to play a very good team in the first round. They played a better team in this first round than they did last season and than they did when they played the Cowboys two seasons ago. This was the best team that the Seahawks have played in a first round of a playoff game. Maybe ever in this.
I don't know if they were better than the Cowboys. A healthy Dak Prescott is a lot different than Jared Goff with a broken finger.
But the dialogue that we had going into that game was that the Cowboys were like 20th in DVOA or something. Maybe it wasn't that bad, but it was that the Cowboys weren't that good in DVOA and the Seahawks were a better team and still lost. And then the Cowboys eventually got better, but it was like, I don't know. I don't. And I think that's what's so frustrating about this is you just leave the game and you're like, what the fuck happened? Right? And there's no obvious answer. There's no let Russ cook. There's no they needed this, they needed that. We're left with a lot of question marks after the game. And I think that's what's really difficult about this loss. And maybe that's what we're here to answer about what happened to the Seahawks offense and where do they go from here.
So we're transitioning to talking about that big picture. You also didn't mention the Darius Williams pick six, which, like, it's a combination of it was apparently a very predictable call because Darius Williams clearly knew it was coming and jumped the route, and the execution of the blocking, you know, if Freddie Swain really had a chance to make that block, who knows, but that was another huge play that a lot of things often happen where a player can even read that right and they just drop the ball or, you know, they stumble or something like that. And it was the worst case outcome of that. given that it was the only screen pass that's been intercepted, the entire to a wide receiver that's been intercepted all NFL season. It was the Malcolm Butler play, except not on the goal line.
Yeah, they're like basically every kind of fluky but high leverage play went the Rams' way, which like I don't think the Seahawks necessarily deserve to win because they didn't play very well, but like that play happened, the muff punt happened, and that deep ball that Jamal Adams probably should have intercepted and at least knocked down, like those three plays, and even the deep shot to DK that Tristan mentioned, like which is like, yeah, Aaron Donald was bearing down on Russell Wilson, but that's also a pass that Russell Wilson can hit, and DK Metcalf was open down the field. So like those, if those plays, some of those plays or all those plays go the Seahawks way, we're probably having a very different conversation. Maybe even like 2 weeks ago against the Rams, where the Seahawks offense in that game as well didn't really get going for most of it. But if you hit on a few plays and your defense makes stops, then that's enough. And that none of that happened for the Seahawks. And here we are.
I mean, we might have the same conversation. It just might be a couple of weeks delayed. A week or two delayed. Okay. So that I think is the point where we can transition to in the first 6 weeks of the season. The Seahawks offense was making all of those plays. All of those deep shots were coming nestling softly in the arms of wide open receivers. And only rarely were they fumbling the ball away prior to the goal line. Not very often. And then, as we talked about last week on the pod, they hit almost none of those shots in the second half of the season. And it's tough to really understand why and why Russell Wilson's performance was so wildly different after what was a triumphant start to this season for those of us that believe Russell Wilson is an underrated quarterback and needs to be given more opportunities. So, you know, Ben, as you start analyzing this, how do you attribute it between, you know, there's surely some element of regression in the mean, other teams adjusting and the Seahawks not being able to counter those adjustments, and just Russell Wilson not being able to maintain that level of play?
Yeah. So I started writing down explanations that I've heard people give, and we can kind of say whether we, or the extent to which we believe different ones of these. And we've gone through a couple of them. So one of them is like the scared of Aaron Donald thing. And that, like, that can't explain the entire second half of the season, right? Because they played a lot of teams that weren't the Rams and struggled against those. One thing I heard, so in the beginning of the stretch, a theory that people had was, well, it was because all their running backs were injured and Russell Wilson didn't trust his protections, and teams were able to blitz and get free runners on Russell Wilson, but then all the running backs came back healthy and they still had the same problem. So that's not it. One thing that I do think is at least part of what's going on is Tyler Lockett hurt his knee against the Rams in the first Rams game this year, and their offense fell off a cliff right after that. And it was exactly the same as what happened last season when Tyler Lockett hurt his knee against the 49ers in that Monday Night Football game, and their offense fell off a cliff. So I think one partial part of what's going on is if Tyler Lockett's not his explosive self, then teams can send their best corner or focus attention on DK Metcalf and pay some attention to Tyler Lockett, and the Seahawks just don't have any other receivers who can beat anybody, and they've chosen not to invest at the position other than drafting DK Metcalf when Doug Baldwin was going to retire. But beyond that, like, they've had chances, they've had draft picks, and they have chosen to not invest at their position. So I think that's hurting them. And then at least in some games, I think the pass protection really has been a factor. Brandon Shell missed a lot of time, and at times his backup struggled, and he did play against the Rams, but their pass protection was obviously not very good in that game. So if you have kind of this combination of the weapons aren't that scary, pass protection is not something that Wilson trusts in, and it seems like Schottenheimer doesn't have a lot of answers for what defenses are throwing at them. If you put that all together, then you get kind of this blah offense that we've been watching. At least that's where I'm at. What do you guys think? Or am I missing something?
I mean, you left out one point that people have made, and that is Russell Wilson has regressed. I'm just trying to cover all of the different points. Yep. And the other one being that Brian Schottenheimer was not able to adjust after the first half of the season.
Yeah. So one other thing is that I think we can discard now is they were kind of saving all of their quote unquote good offense for the playoffs because they were playing a bunch of bad teams and knew they didn't need to actually try. And I think, well, I mean, maybe they were saving their good plays for the Saints next week, but if so, then, well, I'll have to use them next season, I guess. But
this is something that fans believe in a lot and I don't think exists among NFL teams. I'm highly skeptical whether teams actually save the good plays.
I mean, I think maybe for the fourth, you know, like there's a key third down in the fourth quarter, a 2-point play, you know, you're going to need in a big spot. You're probably not going to call that in the first quarter of week four in the same way. But
if you have this play that's like the perfect play or whatever, the chances are you haven't practiced it that much. And the chances are that it might not work. So if you're in these super high leverage situations, I'm skeptical whether you're going to like unfurl the magical play or whatever, or whether teams even have these things. You know what I mean? There's probably stuff that they've worked on a couple of times and they're like, well, shit, this is something we can try out. And they're not going to call that often, but it's more like this is something for down the road, this hypothetical perfect situation. But once you actually get there and it's fourth and two or whatever, and you need 2 yards, you're not going to be like, let's call the play that nobody on the field has ever run before. Unless it's a situation where you're up nine and you need the perfect play to gain 2 yards.
Had the Eagles run Philly special before the Super Bowl?
Well, they had 2 weeks to prepare for it. That's not a comparable situation. That is one specific team having 2 weeks to game plan for another team. But maybe the Patriots are saving this Philly special for week 17 this year. Anyway, I think that is bullshit. The idea of saving plays.
And like maybe they held back some at the beginning of the 49ers game because that game didn't mean a lot, but we're still talking about like half the season where the offense wasn't good. So it's not like a one game or a few game thing. Like it was not great for a long time. So the question about Russell Wilson is like a big question about what we think of the team going forward, because like if he's regressed or if he's not what we thought he was, then that means a lot different than the Seahawks going forward. Like the most important thing you can have is an elite quarterback, and that's how Russell Wilson played during the first half of the season. And it, like, there were a lot of other issues as well, but he just straight up did not play as well in the second half of the season. And we can discuss like the factors why, but at the same time, in a lot of different games there were plays to be made, and he did not play as well as he normally did. And like that first Rams game where he threw that inexplicable interception when he could have scrambled, and like missing deep balls. Yeah, there's a lot of variance there, but he like straight up missed a lot of deep balls the last few weeks. I think we've seen such a large sample of him, and he's still 32, which is before most quarterbacks start regressing, that like going forward, I think our expectations of him should be probably similar to what they were going into this season, but I'm not going to say I'm not at all concerned about what we saw.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, there was a sentiment the first few weeks of the season that looked, it's wildly unfair that Russell Wilson has never gotten an MVP vote, that, you know, he is right there on the same level as Mahomes, and Rodgers has moved, you know, if he was out of that level, which he should have been, he's moved back into it this year. But like, I think one of the things that Rodgers' example shows is like people treat this is more consistent than it is. And the fact that Russ had 8 great weeks at the start of the season didn't necessarily change who he was as a player any more than the fact that he had 8 poor weeks at the end of the year changes it. So one thing I went through this morning and looked at was using NFL FastR. If you do 8 game moving averages of Wilson's completion percentage over expected and his EPA per play as a passer, and there's a lot of, it looks like a random walk. Like there's a lot of ups and downs that, you know, you'd say, oh, well, clearly he's done as a top quarterback. And then all of a sudden he's amazing. And like, so I don't think it tells us anything different going forward, as you said.
Yeah. And maybe the optimistic point is remembering the second half of 2017. And then like even into the first couple of games of 2018, where everything looked like a mess, but obviously he went back to what we would expect from him for a decent stretch after that.
Yeah, I think it's true across all quarterbacks at this level. Quarterbacks who are going to consistently have opportunities to play and start every season, they're going to be ups and downs. I mean, you talked about Aaron Rodgers, who had a multiple down seasons after being at an extraordinarily high level, and then comes back this year and is pretty much the clear MVP. You know, there have been stretches, Pat Mahomes at the end, at the second half of the season, right? Like the idea, the unfortunate thing is that it happened. The takes get decided on which part of the season it comes in. And for Russell Wilson, it happened to come in the second half of the season. And it also means that we're going to go into this offseason and the takes are going to be hot and heavy for, you know, 8 months as they're coming in, because it's the second half of the season. People were going to be debating this point, you know, previously when he had maybe his best stretch beforehand after the 2015 season. Then we were just like, Russell Wilson's the best quarterback in the NFL, because it was the second half of that season and we had 8 months to talk about it. So I think that that piece is frustrating. My expectation and my perception of Russell Wilson has not changed even in the slightest. And, you know, maybe part of this conversation is it's almost defining who you are as a person and who you want to give credit to, right? And the people who we want to give credit to are almost always the players. And Russell Wilson has proven success year after year after year after year. He's given us the opportunity to be excited about football for almost a decade now. So the idea that a bad stretch would change our perception of him, I don't think is a fair perception. And, you know, maybe predictably, the point that I keep coming back to is the position that Russell Wilson was put in. And both the play calling and the pass blocking and run blocking as well, but basically the offensive line in general. And I think that, you know, Kevin went and looked at the first down pass rate. And when people talk about letting Russ cook, there's this misconception that letting Russ cook just means passing the ball over and over and over again. We've talked about this many times, which is, it's not just passing the ball all the time. It's about having a less predictable offense. And when you pass on situations that people are not expecting you to pass, you're more successful in those situations. When you run when you're not expected to run, you're more successful in those situations, unless it's first and 25, which thank you, Seahawks, for that one yesterday. It's about an unpredictability in your offense. And when you do things vanilla, so to say, or when you're like, we're going to line up and we're going to run the ball, those things generally lead to mediocre to bad offense. But keeping defenses on their toes, it is taking advantage of the one advantage that the offense has over the defense. And that is, you know what you're going to do and they don't. And I think in the first half of the season, we looked at an offense that the defenses didn't know what they were going to do. And teams scheme for that. They watch tape of an offense, and over time they understand what you're going to do a little better, and you have to have another mode. And I don't think that the Seahawks had another mode for this. And I think what they did is they shriveled up. And there is, deep to the core of Pete Carroll, fundamentally, who's deciding the overarching philosophy of the offense, and Brian Schottenheimer as offensive coordinator, I think there's a real lack of feel when it comes to offense and how to call plays and when to call plays. And their base for what they're doing, if anything is going wrong at all, is not, maybe we should try calling different types of plays, or maybe we should even lean into this. You know, I think one of the things that's really exciting to see about somebody like Mike Vrabel, if a fourth down doesn't work, it doesn't mean that he's not going to go for the next fourth down. The math is still the same after that. Are you skeptical about that?
I don't know if you're aware of this. Mike Vrabel very famously did not go for a few fourth downs earlier in this very day.
So Mike Vrabel today made the third worst fourth down decision of the entire season.
but there are coaches who, I wasn't watching when that happened.
You especially weren't watching Mina when that happened.
I did see the reaction on Twitter. But there are coaches who believe in the stats, who are going to continue to believe in the stats. It shouldn't be outcome based. It's process based. And that is not the way that the Seahawks view offense. They view it outcome based. Russell Wilson threw a couple of interceptions. They viewed the Buffalo game, in which the Seahawks scored 38 points. Is that right?
They scored that many?
I think it was like 31. I think it was 41-31.
44-34 was the final.
Yeah.
They scored 34 points. And after this game, we viewed that as a failure of offense because there were some turnovers. And then looking at that at the first half of the season versus the second half of the season, I mean, it's such a stark difference. But it wasn't just a difference in play, it was also a difference in some play calling. In the first half of the season, they threw on first down 60% of the time. In the second half of the season, they threw on first down 52% of the time.
This was first and second down win probability between 20 and 80%. I was trying to match. I think you might have changed the let Russ cook meter over time, but that was the original parameters.
Now, why, when things are going badly, would you do the thing that makes you successful more often? And I think that we have to come back to that point, which is the Seahawks, things were going badly for them offensively, and they started putting Russell Wilson in worse positions. And play action, I don't know if there are stats to judge how often a team is running play action or if those are readily available. I can recall maybe one legitimate play action pass yesterday. And still this deep core belief that you have to establish play action, which is fucking bullshit. And we know it's bullshit. And even Troy Aikman knows, right? People who are not necessarily the Matt LaFleurs of the world, the Sean McVays of the world, know this. And I'm highly skeptical whether the Seahawks offensive staff really gets that. So things got tough. And what they did when things got tough in the season is they put Russell Wilson into a worse position offensively. And that to me makes no sense at all.
So I'm glad you brought this up, because this is something else we should have touched on in the what's wrong with Russell Wilson discussion. And another possibility is the Seahawks coaching staff, after the 10 turnovers in three games or whatever it was after the Cardinals and Bills games, especially hammered into Russell Wilson that you cannot turn the ball over. Seahawks football is we take care of the football, we play defense, and that's how we're going to win games. And we've seen in the second half of the season so many times Russell Wilson just being extremely cautious about when to throw the football, and that leads to him being indecisive and taking a lot of sacks. And I think that's a potential explanation about like why he has been playing how he's been playing. Just like the coaching staff is just so incredibly turnover averse and that gets drilled into his head. And I think that affects how he's playing. And I think the emphasis on turnovers is overstated, because yeah, turning the ball over is bad, but it's also bad if you don't score points and you kind of have to balance those two. And I think the balance is not right with kind of Pete Carroll's vision of football.
You got to break a few eggs to make an omelet. I mean, and the other aspect of it is, you know, he cites the turnover differential stats, which are accurate, but there's an element of chicken or egg there, to go back to the omelet. Because part of the reason you turn the ball over more frequently is because you're trailing and forced to take more risks. So if you can put yourself in a situation where you're leading, that tends to reduce turnovers as well. I think, though, the point we haven't discussed enough is the defense is adjusting. And it's something that you brought in Mahomes. We've seen this with Kansas City as well, where with both of those offenses, which started out very well, teams have gone from playing primarily cover one based looks with a single high safety to a lot of cover two based looks, which the Rams in particular are at the forefront of in the NFL, and trying to take away deep shots and force you to come back underneath. And I think it's going to be really fascinating to see how offenses adjust to that with an entire offseason. It kind of reminds me of like the 2012 season, where the Seahawks offense took off midseason after incorporating the read option. We saw the same thing with Kaepernick in San Francisco. And then it was like the entire offseason, all defenses were working on how do we figure out the read option? And they didn't totally solve it. And Kaepernick did come out and throw for like 350 yards on the Packers in week one the next season after he had run for 150 on them in the playoffs. But they did come to more of an equilibrium. And I wonder if we're going to see that with the two high looks.
So the weird thing about this is I think it's the Vikings that have done that to Seattle three seasons in a row, where Russell Wilson has looked not great against the Vikings defense, and they just kind of let safety sit back and not give up the deep shots. And seeing all these other defenses do that now, it's like, what took everyone so long to realize that, like, what the Seahawks want to do is run the football and throw it deep. And if you take away the deep balls, then it really puts a damper on the Seahawks being able to score points, really. And like, maybe it's an adjustment, but it's something that it's not like it was a mystery and has never happened to the Seahawks before. And like, maybe it took the Seahawks offense being so exceptional the first few weeks of the season for other defenses to really like think about how they needed to slow it down, but it like the whole thing is just kind of mysterious to me.
I mean, to be clear, I don't think it reflects well on the offensive creativity either way. And just,
I agree. Yeah.
The thing that frustrates me is it feels like the Seahawks very often, very, very rarely deceive the other team. I mean, obviously play action is that
very rarely. There's like one fucking time in the last 8 weeks that they deceive the other team. Like it is such an understatement to say very rarely deceive the other team. How many of these games did it look like the defense knew exactly what play was coming? The same shit generous. That happened yesterday. Like, seriously, we've had games since the Giants game on. It has felt like defenses have known precisely what play was coming, even sometimes in the Jets game, precisely what play was coming before the Seahawks ran it.
Yeah, so that's the frustrating part about watching like the Packers or the Chiefs and all these teams that generate so many layup throws for their quarterbacks, where like especially watching the Packers defenses just look absolutely lost playing against them. And then you turn to the Seahawks and everything feels so like static and just like not creating advantages for their players and just like asking their players to go out and beat the other players without having any inherent advantages that the offense should have.
I mean, it's probably not a fair comparison because those are probably the two of the best offenses in the league, right? And have tons of weapons that maybe the Seahawks don't have, but scheme wise, how many fucking times have we seen Robert Tonyan wide open for a touchdown, right? Like they're just playing in fantasy football, right? You're just like, how do the Packers constantly have players wide open, right? Everything they do, the defenses have no idea what is coming when watching the Packers. And I think that's the piece that the Seahawks just, you know, they talked about that. I have no idea how true this is, but it took Aaron Rodgers a year to buy into the scheme or whatever, right? When does Brian Schottenheimer buy into the scheme? When does Pete Carroll buy into the scheme? Like, this works, what you're doing. Misdirection works. Play action works. Motion at the line of scrimmage works. And for some reason, it just was gone. There was one play, I want to say, maybe this was 2 weeks ago, where the Seahawks ran like beautiful play action pass and had Tyler Lockett wide open, right? And it was just like, where was that? Like, is this one of those plays that they've been hiding for weeks? Where are those drives that happen where everything is clicking? And it feels like, you know, even if they hit that pass to DK Metcalf yesterday, there's no feel on offense whatsoever, right? It's just like, I hope this play works. I hope this play works. Hope Russ makes a pass here, right? Hope we gain 4 yards on a carry here. Maybe somebody will break a tackle. At no point is there like things are moving in motion, right? When you watch the successful offenses, you're like, we're going to do this. That player is going to be open. This is going to cause that to be open. This motion here is going to make them do that. And we're going to respond to it like this. And I don't think that Brian Schottenheimer sees the chessboard that way and is to the serious detriment of the Seahawks in the second half of the season. And they shrunk it all down. You know, they said our defense is playing well. Let's shrink it all down. Let's pretend it's 2013 again, which it wasn't 2013 again. The offense was playing better then and the defense was better.
Yeah, I think that's the question that the Schottenheimer truthers / defenders need to answer is like, why it looks so much harder for the Seahawks offense than some of these other offenses. Like even watching the Rams, they had, like, I know the Seahawks defense is not the Rams defense, but they're like, Sean McVay is very good at what he does and is able to create conflicts in the defense that create easy throws for his quarterback. And it just feels, and obviously the 49ers too, Shanahan's very good at what he does. We mentioned the Packers, the Chiefs, like there are these teams that have very good play callers and create advantageous situations for their offenses and especially their quarterbacks. And that's like, I don't know how you could watch the Seahawks offense and think that Schottenheimer is at the same level or anywhere near the same level as those guys. And if he's not, then like, why are we wasting Russell Wilson's like the last few years of his physical prime with somebody who's not a great offensive coordinator?
I mean, I do feel like what happened on Saturday was bad enough and shocking enough to Pete Carroll that it may force some level of rethinking.
You're tripping right now. Go on. Finish what you're saying.
I mean, we did see, like, 2018, the run-pass ratio was as far to the not cookie, let Russ cook as you could possibly go. And 19, you know, they got a little more balance. And 20, they passed a lot. So, you know, maybe there is a willingness to think a little more creatively. The question is, you know, going to be, do they have the personnel to do that? Now, as has been noted, they may have some changes on the coaching staff, even though it doesn't seem like Brian Schottenheimer is probably going to be a real strong head coaching candidate after Saturday.
Please, Lord.
But Brendan Carroll, who was the run game coordinator, took the offensive coordinator job at Arizona, and it was reported today that Dave Canales, the passing game coordinator, is interviewing for a college job as well as an offensive coordinator. So it's possible they could have some new blood offensively next season.
This is Pete Carroll's team. Like, it comes from Pete and Shoddy.
But there, we do know that within that framework of not turning the ball over and wanting to be a physical running team, there are still ways to be more creative with your passing within that framework. Because it's not like the Rams run the ball a lot. Like, it's not like they're a constant passing team. They run the ball a lot. It's just they use that to set up bootlegs and things like that that create more misdirection.
I just don't see Pete Carroll taking that game yesterday and saying to himself, we need to pass more. Maybe he'll look at it and be like, we need to be more creative on offense. I suppose. I nothing about Pete Carroll and his 75-year-old history. Is he 75 now? Older?
Nothing 69. About
69. Okay. Nothing about Pete Carroll and his history with the Seahawks has suggested that that's going to be the case. And I think assuming that that is the one thing is, we know that Pete Carroll is very reactionary, and who knows whether this is Pete or John, whatever ended the previous season is what they're going to work ridiculously hard to try to do better the next season. And
run defense.
Yeah, exactly. I'm curious, like, maybe that's it. Coming out of this game, I don't look at anything on offense and say to myself, that's what Pete Carroll is going to be like. We need to attack this, right? Because, and
it does not like three and outs.
If there is one piece of it, I would hope going into the offseason that it's offensive line and putting tons of resources there, and especially draft capital on the offensive line, because I think that has to be another question. You know, there's this time period. Look, maybe if they had more time to develop some of these long passes. I mean, DK was getting open downfield. They just didn't have time to get those passes off. And it wasn't just against the Rams. It happened against the fucking Giants, against the 49ers, right? Like, they were terrorized on the offensive line for the entire second half of the season. So I think there are a lot of different elements here. Russ didn't play as well as he was playing in the first half of the season, maybe even his baseline for his career. I think the play calling, given the situation, was legitimately bad. And then also the offensive line really didn't give them the opportunity to necessarily hit some of those plays, because they're not fast plays. It's part of the reason that you need to keep the defense on their toes, so they can't tee off, so to say, right? They can't come at you every play, but the Rams were doing it with four defensive linemen on the field. This wasn't blitzing. This was destroying the Seahawks offensive line. And I think they've got to put a lot of time and energy into building up talent, both as starting and depth on that offensive line.
How many seasons of Russell Wilson's career do you think we could have said the exact same thing?
The more question is, how many could we not have said?
Yeah.
That's a smaller number.
I want to hear Ben's answer to, if the question is what happened to the Seahawks offense and you had to break it down to one or two points, what, I feel like I've said a lot here. What is your perspective on that question?
I think the three things are pass protection. Whether or not the pass protection was good in a given game, I don't think Wilson believed that it was good. And I think that affected his play. So I think that is number one. So I definitely agree that the pass protection needs to get better, and it needs to be something that Wilson can trust in and actually like hang in the pocket and make like go through his progressions and like run the offense as called when the protection is holding up. Obviously it did not hold up on it. Was that yesterday? Yeah. It feels like a long time ago. It did not hold up yesterday, but there were games where I think the protection was okay, and Wilson just did not trust the offensive line. So I think it does need to be better, and I think that would have helpful impacts on Wilson. And I think the Lockett injury really did damage their offense too. So I would put those as kind of the 1A, 1B in terms of like what happened to the Seahawks offense. And I guess 1C is the defensive adjustments / lack of Seahawks play calling being able to attack into those adjustments. So like in terms of what needs to be better for the Seahawks offense, I think they need a credible receiving threat that's not Lockett or Metcalf, or they need Lockett and Metcalf to never get hurt, which is probably not realistic. And I think they need an upgrade at left guard for sure, because like that was just a turnstile, especially yesterday, and that was not helpful.
Is this where we transition to talking about the unit of the team that actually was far weaker this season? Like, as much as we've lamented the offense, and certainly deservedly so after Saturday, I mean, do we trust that the defense is going to be capable going forward because of what we saw in the second half of the season where they weren't really tested against any elite offenses?
So I think like my view of NFL defenses is all defenses are about the same except in the extremes. So like some defenses are extremely good, like the Rams, and maybe only the Rams this season. And then there's some defenses that are extremely bad, like the Raiders, Texans, Lions, that group. And then everyone else I think is probably about the same. So trusting the Seahawks defense to be top five or top 10 in any given season is probably not a reasonable expectation. And I don't even think they have the talent to expect that anyway. It's not like they have an elite secondary or pass rush. And yeah, their linebackers are good, but that's two players out of 11. So I'm sure Pete Carroll wants to go into any given season believing in his defense and believing that he's going to have a good defense, but I do not think that's a realistic expectation.
I'm going to guess the question is this: if the Seahawks offense stays at the same level it was over the course of 2020, and maybe it isn't so first half heavy, do we think the defense would be good enough for a long playoff run in that case?
I don't think so. I think the only way this team is like at its current level is has a realistic shot at getting into a deep playoff run is to somehow luck into the number one seed and just start in the second round of the playoffs, and then only need to win two playoff games to get to the Super Bowl. Because like, I just don't think they're nearly as good as a lot of other teams in the NFC, and they really need the first half offense to be competitive with those other teams.
Yeah, it might be the case. I do feel optimistic about, you know, the addition of DJ Reed. Like, that solidified a position that was probably the biggest problem among a number of them on the defense in the first half of the season. I think they probably can sustain something similar to the second half pass rush that may not be good enough against better offenses, but it at least gives them a chance in a way that they didn't, you know, have a chance of stopping teams the first 6 weeks of the season.
Where I keep getting hung up on is, like, can you imagine the Seahawks if they had to play against the Packers or the Buccaneers? And like, they're just worse than probably on both sides of the ball, and especially on offense, than both of those teams. And like last year, than the 49ers, and in some years the Saints. And they're like, it just feels like they're so far behind talent wise. Even if you think Wilson is as good of a quarterback as those other quarterbacks, they don't have the pass protection, they don't have the play calling. And there's no reason to expect their defense to be miles better than those other teams. So like, it's all, this is turning very depressing very quickly, but like, it all feels like a long shot for them to get back deep into the playoffs.
I mean, I still finished fifth in overall team DVOA. Is that where they're at right now? right. Weighted is fifth also.
I don't know if I believe that much in DVOA this year.
Well, and also it can't be anything worse.
Like, yeah, exactly.
I'm pretty skeptical about that also. But, you know, I agree with you that they're not at the level of the Packers or the Chiefs or the Buccaneers this season. Who knows, going into next year with, you know, Tom Brady at 43 years old or whatever. But like, if they could pair the first half offense and the second half defense, I feel like you have a Super Bowl caliber team with those two things. Granted, the first half offense was one of the best offenses in the league. And if you pair them with almost any defense, even if you reach the level of average, I mean, they were 7-1 after 8 games. Is that right?
6-2. Buffalo was the 8th game.
That was the 8th game. Okay. So if they're, you know, like that is a Super Bowl caliber team, right? It was a Super Bowl caliber offense. Even being 6-2 with a loss at Buffalo and a loss at Arizona, you're saying to yourself, this is a team that could have made a long playoff run. But the base has to be, we've talked about this before, great offense and average defense.
And great offense and hot defense.
Hot defense, good enough defense, right? And they got to that point of the defense was, we wouldn't have, if the offense was playing the way that they were, obviously at the beginning of the season, we would have gone into a game at New Orleans or something like that and said to ourselves, we can win this game. We can go into New Orleans and beat them with the defense where they were in the second half. The problem was those two things didn't hit at the same time. And pretty much the minute that the defense started playing better, the offense got worse. Whether those two things are related or not, I don't know. I feel like the answer is probably no, because it seems like some of the defensive progression that happened was because of health and, you know, getting Carlos Dunlap in the building and stuff like that. If they could have been maybe even slightly worse with good offense, I feel like they're a legit contender for a Super Bowl. I mean, like, they are a game away from potentially having the number one seed. You know, like, we've broken this down as a couple of plays in the season that feels like a lost season or whatever. They still were, you know, a stupid Benson Mayoa play away from being the number one seed, right? Tiny, tiny things away from being the number one seed. Obviously, there was some luck on the other side, but like, it's not an easy feat to be the number one seed in the NFC. I don't think they're that far away from, you know, being at that level of the other NFC favorites.
Yeah, I don't think it's a chasm between them and those other teams. I mean, the thing is, like, look, if we had looked at the Packers, even though they made the NFC Championship game, if we'd looked at them using the same rubric a year ago, you would have said, look, Aaron Rodgers is old, has been struggling several years. What's going to make next year any better for him? You know, we already tried changing head coaches and offensive philosophies, and it didn't take. You know, the defense was very fortunate last season and probably can't sustain it. And then lo and behold, all those things worked out for the Packers. So I do believe philosophically in the NFL, and like, there is value in just being in the mix and that everything is going to break your way at some point. But it is also a bummer to have Russell Wilson in his prime and playing at this level and miss out on another season of advancing even to the championship game.
Yeah, that's definitely the optimistic view, is the Seahawks will probably be in the mix every year, almost every year that they have Russell Wilson. So that's like, thank you for Russell Wilson. We're very blessed to watch him play. It may have been frustrating the last couple months, but there are so many teams who are in, like, watching the Bears right now. Like, the Seahawks are not the Bears. It could be much, much worse. So let's acknowledge that at the same time.
That's what I keep coming back to, though, is you look at sort of those quarterbacks for the last couple of decades, who Rodgers, Breeze, Ben Roethlisberger, Brady, you know, to maybe even a larger extent, who they're just always in the mix. And there is a divide there. There's kind of the Philip Rivers line, right? Like, are you Phil Rivers? Even then, though, the Chargers were 12-4 a couple of seasons ago with Phil Rivers as their quarterback. Like, as long as you have a quarterback who's at that level and you can stay in the mix, and if it is somebody like Breeze and you can eventually pair them with a great defense, the part to me that I think is different from some of those other quarterbacks is many of them, I will say, have had offensive philosophies that wanted to maximize their talents. And I feel like Russell Wilson is maybe in a position where, for any of the quarterbacks who've reached that level, top 5 to 10 quarterbacks in the league, maybe let's say top 5 quarterbacks of the last decade, right? Who have such a fundamental divide between what their coach and what their offensive staff want to do and their ability. And it's pretty rare that we've seen somebody like Ben Roethlisberger, like Drew Brees, right? Be like, wow, they're really hamstrung by their coaching staffs. You know, it feels like those coaching staffs want to put those players in a position to succeed. Same with Rodgers. And that's how it happens. And usually it just takes finding the right defense to build around those quarterbacks. And when that happens, and with Rodgers, there was some progression that happened this year, or I guess maybe even regression to the mean for Rodgers after being down for a couple of years. I'm a little bit nervous with Russell Wilson that he's doing what he can, but is not being put into the position to succeed by those coaching staffs to even necessarily be able to reach those heights.
Yeah. So the Rodgers example is interesting because when Rodgers was exactly Russell Wilson's age, that was his 2015 season and probably his worst season, like either watching him or statistically, I think he finished like number 18 in EPA per play or something. So it's not like Wilson has fallen that far, but what eventually turned around Rodgers was getting a coaching staff with a progressive vision about what NFL offense should be in 2020 and going beyond. But with Wilson, like, that's not going to happen, right? Pete Carroll just signed an extension and he's not going to change who he is. So like, we can say, yeah, Rodgers is awesome now, just like he was before, but it also took a large change around him that is not going to happen with Wilson. So with Wilson, he just like somehow has to elevate his circumstances like he did for the beginning part of the season, because it's hard to see a lot else changing around him.
So Justin, you wanted to talk about reasons for optimism from this season?
There was a tweet where somebody was like, is this the least talked about 12-4 team? I'm just like, who? I don't really know if there are that many talked about 12-4 teams that lose in the first round or whatever. Like, it's just such a strange way to judge something. It feels like the Seahawks team didn't maybe go as far in the playoffs as maybe they should have, right? If you were to look at them being number 5 in DVOA, you would say that they should win a playoff game. I still say, like, does it really matter? Like, if we win one playoff game and we're having this conversation a week later, do we feel that much better about ourselves? You know, like,
yes,
because
is the team
going to be talked about more?
We've gotten through one more dark, cold week of January during the midst of a pandemic.
And I think that that's really important, right? Jan was just like, I don't even know what I'm going to do with my life if the Seahawks lose. And I'm like, they would probably lose next week. You know, like, that's the reality of the situation, is they didn't have the number one seed. We didn't go into this playoffs saying that there's a good chance of them playing into February. You know, they lost this week to the Rams because they played a very good team. And, you know, if they would have played the Bears or they would have played Washington, they probably would have won and lost next week. Like, that's the bigger question. But they still went 12-4, right? Like, this was the best record that they've had since they last went to a Super Bowl. You know, like, this was an impressive season that the Seahawks played. And I think that piece is getting lost in the mix a little bit because they finished it pretty poor, right? And they still won a lot of these games at the end of the year too, which to me is part of it is just like, people love seeing offense, which is awesome. And it's kind of funny how there seems to be sort of like a rejection of offense when it's going well, but then when it's not going well, we say that everything is terrible with the team. Right, like
they were legitimately boring to watch.
Like, oh yeah, no,
it was not a fun
awful.
Viewing experience.
They were awful to watch, right? But like, they still went 12-4. This was a good season, and the other piece has to be said that the Seahawks played a season during the middle of a pandemic. They kept the team completely healthy from any COVID cases, and they kept the city of Seattle healthy and entertained. And that's the most important part of it, right? Because at the same time, we watched the Seahawks' first home playoff game since 2017, and there weren't fans in the building. It was completely lifeless. You know, they hosted a playoff game in the year that it was the worst year in the city of Seattle, if you're going to think about keeping the citizens of your city safe, which fortunately our local politicians have. If you're going to be doing that, it was the worst year to host a playoff game. Right? There was just no energy at all in that stadium yesterday. Would the outcome have been different if there were fans? Maybe. I don't know. Right? But we know that home field advantage was basically nil this year. And we had something to talk about and distract us every Sunday, something that felt normal, right? Like this NFL season, there was a time period in the middle of it where it's like, man, the season is fucked. Games were on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Things felt really off. It was just like, they're going to have to pull the plug on the whole thing. But
the NBA is currently entering that stage.
Yes. They figured it out, maybe for better or worse, but the Seahawks weren't necessarily part of that. And they played when they were supposed to play every single week and entertained us for a whole year. And we got to see another year of Russell Wilson's prime. He won 12 games. You know, we saw DK Metcalf turn into one of the best receivers in the league, if not, you know, the most exciting receiver in the league. This was a fun season. You know, it's easy to forget that at the very end, but this was a fun season of football. They didn't go 7-9. We're not the Las Vegas Raiders here. Like there's so many worse fates out there than this particular fate. And I think that's getting a little bit lost in the mix and being too upset about a 12-4 season is what leads to people making brash decisions or doing things that might not be good for the long-term future of the franchise. And I think that piece, I don't want that piece to be too widespread, because staying the course is probably the most important thing they can do with a new offensive coordinator.
Yeah, I think when I look back, eventually when I look back on the season, I think what I will most remember is the feeling of watching them in that first game against the Falcons after spending 6 months of a pandemic, wondering if there's going to be a football season, wondering if we're going to watch the Seahawks. And then at 10 a.m. Pacific in week one, the Seahawks are playing football. It's like, holy crap, we're watching the Seahawks play football. And it was just like, I could not believe that I was watching Russell Wilson throw passes to Tyler Lockett on my TV screen. And it's like, it's easy to like become a fan and become upset about what is happening, and especially in the second half of the season. But if you are only into sports to watch your team win a championship, then you're going to be very disappointed in the vast majority of seasons. So you have to find meaning in other ways, I think. And like watching what the Seahawks did during the first half of the season, watching them play at all, like being able to have a quarterback like Russell Wilson and players like Bobby Wagner and Tyler Lockett, like all these things are like, it's very easy to forget and get frustrated because sports do that to us too. But these things are like such tremendous blessings. And I fully agree that we should appreciate them while we do have them.
As frustrating as Pete Carroll may be as an in-game coach, I feel like granting that he had the advantage of the fact that, you know, local government has taken this more seriously than in many parts of the country, and therefore the rates in King County are as low as just about any major metropolitan region in the country. Going through the season, we'll see what happened with Jonathan Bullard, who was placed on the COVID-19 list before the playoff game, and we never got an update on that. If they actually went through the entire season without a positive test for any of their players, that is like maybe the most impressive accomplishment of Pete Carroll's career. Like, that's incredible. Everyone else got wrecked by this and not the Seahawks. And that's amazing. Now I'm going to
It's not just a fluke. Like, he talked about how important this was. Like, you need to like keep your distance from people even during Thanksgiving. And like, he made this a strong and consistent message to his players. And like, there's obviously a lot of randomness with who gets infected and who's not. And it's not like everyone who got infected did something wrong necessarily, but like Pete Carroll himself was very good on like messaging and treating this like the pandemic that it is. So absolutely hats off to him for this.
I guess what I'm saying here is Joe Biden, hire Pete Carroll for the CDC.
So the Seahawks can have a new coach. Sorry.
Now I'm going to give you the pessimistic take, which is, okay, everything you guys said is right, but I'm just so fucking tired of having these same arguments over and over again about the Seahawks. I just want any other argument besides, well, are they passing enough? Whose fault is it? Russ's fault? Is it Shoddy's fault? Is it the offensive line's fault? I just want something new to argue about.
Let me tell you what argument fucking sucks.
Why didn't they go for that fourth down?
Or nope. Mitchell Trubisky. That argument sucks. You know what I mean? Is Derek Carr the guy? That argument
doesn't suck.
That argument sucks. Matt Stafford is our quarterback and the highest paid quarterback in the NFL. That argument sucks, right? Having even Matt Ryan as your quarterback, every single one of these conversations sucks so much more than what we have to deal with. I'm sure that there were Saints fans when the Saints were going 7-9 who are just like, God, it's the same thing over and over and over again. They'll never have a defense. We keep talking about this. And then, Saints have been winning a lot lately. They have not been to a Super Bowl since. But I'm sure that they've been very happy to see that winning. We haven't seen the darkness as Seahawks fans. The closest we came was a 9-7 season that they missed the playoffs. Just wait, because it gets a lot worse than this.
I don't know if you're aware of this. The Seahawks suffered probably the single most painful loss in the history of the Super Bowl.
It's different, though. I'm telling you, it's different.
Okay.
I mean, and also we should be so, you're tired of that. We're here talking about desperate for a basketball team back. We would fucking kill to have the equivalent of a 12-4 season and lose in the playoffs. I mean, think about that first Vin Baker season, right? Or the couple of Vin Baker seasons. We were just so bored of winning at that point. But you know what? The team could be gone. Or you could have two decades of mediocre play, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was ready to introduce the new arguments, which are about what the Seahawks should do this offseason. So the Seahawks have about $17.6 million in cap space heading into the 2021 season per over the cap, which might sound like a lot until you go through the list of free agents, because there's a lot ranked in terms of starts this season. KJ Wright, 16. Puna Ford, 16. He's restricted. Ethan Posick, 14. All of those that he was injured for, the other two. Chris Carson, 12. Same thing. Shaquille Griffin, 12. Same thing. Mike Iupati, 10. Benson Mayowa, 9. Greg Olsen, 8. Presumably he's going to retire after not really being a factor at all on Saturday. Jordan Simmons, who split time with Iupati at left guard, 6. He's also restricted. David Moore is the third wide receiver, 6. Quentin Dunbar, 6. He probably doesn't factor into their plans. Jacob Hollister, 5. Bruce Irvin, 2 before he was injured at the very start of the season. And Carlos Hyde, who started one game in place of Carson. So how do you find $18 million for all of those players?
Yeah, so the big question marks are Griffin and Wright, I think.
And Carson. And,
yeah, so like in an ideal world. Yeah. So in an ideal world, they just let him walk and like figure out the running back position because it doesn't matter.
They haven't extended him. So they might be willing to let him go if the price is not right.
Yeah, and maybe the coming cap crunch will encourage him or encourage them in that way. But yeah, and him not being able to stay healthy probably doesn't help his market either. But like if he gets a mid-tier running back offer from some other team, then like, do we really think the Seahawks are going to pass that up?
Probably not, but I don't think it's a fait accompli.
I think you're probably right, but just he's a long-term starter who's in the sort of same position as somebody like KJ and Shaquille Griffin.
But he is also at a position that they spent a first-round pick on a couple of years ago, and unfortunately, Rashad Penny had the ACL injury himself, and you know maybe the situation would be different if he had been healthy the whole time. But so there's no obvious cut candidates. Like normally, you look at it, and there's someone. It's like okay, they'll save $2 million. By cutting this player and he's a bit player, like that's going to happen for sure. And that doesn't exist. So I think the biggest decision in terms of guys who are under contract is going to be Carlos Dunlap, who's got a $10.8 million non-guaranteed base salary for next season. And as part of the trade to Seattle, they agreed to restructure his deal to lower his cap hit for 2020, but gave him a $3 million roster bonus due on the fifth year of the 2021 league year. He has $1 million in additional bonuses. So basically the Seahawks need to either decide to restructure that into a long-term deal that cuts down his cap number, or they will have to waive him despite the fact that he was so good for them this season.
I would hope that they turn that into a long-term deal because he was very unhappy with the Bengals, understandably so, after so many years never winning there, and seems to be happy with the Seahawks and their culture and everything, and he was a good player for them. So if they can turn him into a long-term deal with a reasonable price, then yeah, that sounds great. And if not, at least keep him on the roster for next season, I would think.
And then the last key decision facing the Seahawks is Jamal Adams' extension, which we know is going to happen. It's a question of how much and how that's structured. You could actually probably structure it so that it reduces his cap hit, because he's due $9.9 million in strictly base salary next year in the final year, the option year of his rookie contract. So if you convert some of that base salary to a bonus that he gets the money now, but it counts against the cap long term, that's a way that the Seahawks can reduce his cap hit while also getting him signed up long term.
Yeah, so this one's really hard. If coming into this year, I would say from Adam's perspective, like there's no reason to sign until actually hitting the free agent market, unless you just get like a way above market deal, which we've seen with other players that had massive amounts traded for them. But I think he probably hurt what he would get from another team if he were to hit the market, and thus reduce his leverage this season, both because of the injuries and also like, it's not like he blew everyone away with this play while healthy. So maybe that means that they can come to some sort of agreement. And the Seahawks, I think this is a bad way to think about things, but the Seahawks gave up so much for him that they kind of have to keep him. So they should be, or they probably will be motivated to do this.
But I want to hear your thoughts on KJ Wright and Shaquille Griffin as well, Ben. Cut you off there.
It depends on price. But like KJ Wright was great this season, and like obviously knows the defense and has been there forever. So if they can bring him back at a reasonable price, then yeah, might as well do it. With Griffin, I would also lean towards yes. You need cornerbacks, and yes, DJ Reed was good, but that's one player, and you need other players on the field too. So as long as the price is reasonable, I think Griffin would probably be my top priority to bring back, just because being able to cover is so important. And trying to think of anyone else I might be missing, but I don't think so.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And just their inability to develop a corner besides him. I mean, Trey Flowers has not been able to step into that role over the last few years as they hoped. So, you know, even with DJ Reed's emergence, there's still a need there. So, all right, is tradition on this podcast, let's go through these guys player by player and see whether we think they're going to be back or not, and then we will never pay attention to this after the offseason. Starting with KJ Wright.
I think one year we actually like went back and reviewed our prediction.
We did when we had you on before the start of the week.
But now we don't do that anymore because we don't want to embarrass ourselves. But I think KJ Wright will be back.
Yeah, he's back in.
I think he's back in on what's effectively a one-year deal, but structured as a multi-year deal, again, for cap purposes, which someday they're going to have this cap crunch is really going to hit. And that's, hey, very Saints-like. Worked out for them in the end. Puna Ford.
Well, this is terrible podcast material, but it is the first quarter of Browns-Steelers, and the score is Browns 28, Steelers 0.
What? You're not following this, Tristan? Oh, the Saints are outstanding.
Oh my goodness. The Steelers had four possessions and they had turnovers in three possessions, including the Browns scoring a touchdown on a defensive touchdown on the first play of the game. What is this?
Was that a fumbled snap? Because I'm only looking at the box score and I said there was Marquise Pouncey who had the fumble.
It says aborted snap. I haven't seen any tweets or anything. I just checked the score. Okay. Wow. So we're not missing much because this game's over.
Hoping for an interesting game. I mean, I hope that the Steelers come back to make it interesting, because this weekend has been super wild card weekend. Has not been the best.
I did want this outcome, though, because I want Ravens-Bills. Yeah, I think that's going to be a great matchup. Anyways, Puna Ford.
Is he an unrestricted free agent?
He's restricted.
Oh, restricted? Yeah, he'll be back then, I think.
Yeah, he's in.
Back. We're going to need to disagree on someone at some point here. Ethan Posick.
This one's hard because he's a center and you can kind of find centers anywhere, but I'll say back.
I think he's probably back. I mean, they have no real replacement for him at this point. I mean, again, we'd hope that they're spending a lot of capital on linemen in the draft this year, but hopefully not on a center.
Maybe their first round pick.
They need to be thinking about left tackle and a replacement for Dwayne Brown long term. That's what they need to be thinking about, really, along with potentially left guard. Also agrees back. Chris Carson.
I'll say back.
I think he's probably gone. I think they definitely drafted Rashad Penny with the expectation that he was going to take this job from Chris Carson. And while I'm pretty skeptical about what the market is going to look like for running backs, that is one place that the NFL usage-wise has not necessarily figured out running backs and their value. As far as on the free market, you know, I think it's going to be a pretty slim market for Carson out there. But I still think at the same time, the Seahawks look at this as this is Rashad Penny's job, and they'll go find another running back some other way.
I guess I'm just going to say back on all of these guys. I don't know, man. I guess it's more likely on each of them individually, but in the aggregate, one of them probably will go. Yeah. Quill.
Yeah, back.
Definitely back.
Back. Iupati's probably not important enough to be worth mentioning. Benson Mayoa.
This is hard. I'll say gone. I don't have a strong feeling, but I think he had a decent second half of the year, I want to say, and might get some offer that will price him out of Seattle's range.
I think he's probably gone. I could see Irvin and Mayoa being ones who kind of linger for a while. And the Seahawks want to feel out what that market looks like for them. I mean, they obviously overpaid for both this season, even though Benson Mayoa came in pretty helpful with the injuries on the defensive line that happened, and, you know, not being able to get anything out of Darrell Taylor, who they definitely expected something from. You know, at some point, they're going to have to start moving some young players in there, though.
Which, I mean, guys were part of the rotation this year. So I think there's only room probably for one of Mayoa or Irvin, and I think they can get a better bargain on Irvin coming off the ACL injury. So I think he'll be back and Mayoa will be gone.
Okay.
David Moore?
I'll say gone. He's fine, but they can find David Moore's anywhere, I think.
I'll agree with that. I mean, this is another piece that you brought up with the Tyler Lockett injury and the refusal to find a third receiver, you know, and to the Josh Gordon question is also out there, and really, you know, the murkiness that surrounded it. You know, I think that lack of information, it was almost Pac-12 like, but if Josh Gordon had been there as a third option and come in, you know, who knows what his, you know, physical ability is at this point. I think it could have made a difference. The second half of the season, having another option, David Moore just isn't, you know, and if they can go out in the draft and find a receiver in the third or fourth round who can actually come in and play, I think that'd be pretty exciting, and will not be David Moore next year.
Yeah, we're all in agreement here. I think they definitely, not that they have that many of these, they need to draft a wide receiver in the top three rounds is what I would say.
So the second...
Yeah, I guess
they still have their third round pick. Yeah, isn't it just the second round?
Yeah, the third round pick went to Jamal in the Jamal Adams trade as well. So yeah, it's only the round two pick at this point. So I guess I'm saying forget about the offensive line for now and draft a wide receiver. So we probably don't even really need to talk about draft priorities because, Jamal Adams, he had many sacks.
He did.
Anything else we should cover talking about the Seahawks offseason?
I think it has to be said just how little they've gotten from a couple of consecutive draft classes, and why we're talking about this situation, why we're having these conversations is the talent on the roster that has come in as far as young players in these last couple of years has been pretty brutal. And, you know, when you miss on a couple of draft classes like this, you know, we're not talking about looking at LJ Collier as, you know, we're still having the conversation about whether Benson Mayoa or Bruce Irvin are coming back. We're not like, well, they have LJ Collier, right?
I mean, I think Collier is definitely going to be in the mix next season. He did start every game officially,
right? But like, the as far as when we're talking about if this is a championship caliber defense, LJ Collier is not part of that conversation.
LJ Collier is what they want him to be. It's just what they want him to be is not worth a first round pick.
Exactly. You don't spend, he's worth a fourth round pick, right? Like the same with Jordan Brooks. I mean, they spend another first round pick on, I think Jordan Brooks is going to be a very good football player, but he's somebody who is off the field for half the snaps this year. Right. And so if you're first with your first round pick, I mean, they could have gone and gotten a white star wide receiver. You know, there are a couple of young star wide receivers that were drafted after Jordan Brooks was drafted, and the Seahawks chose to take a linebacker at a place that they're really deep. They're so consumed with the idea of filling out the linebacking core, right? Which is just like value wise, maybe down there at the bottom of the least important positions that you could have. And I think that has to be said, that there's not a lot of talent coming out of these two draft classes that we're really relying on. You know, Damian Lewis looked very good this year, and I think that's one player we can feel really good from this class. Jordan Brooks, when he was playing, looked really good, but otherwise, I mean, they couldn't even get a good fucking late round running back. Like, and everybody could do that.
It's not just two draft classes. Who was their first round pick in 2018? It was a running back. And like there were ample opportunities to take other positions there, but they, like, their big picture understanding of like what positions matter and what positions like change your franchise and win football games. Like, you should not be spending a first round pick on a running back when you have all these other needs. And as Tristan said, we've seen these decisions, like a running back, a run stuffing defensive end, and a linebacker have been their first round picks in the last three drafts. And that's like, that just really limits your upside for what you're going to get out of the top of the draft.
The Colby Parkinson pick to me is just like the most baffling of all of them, how they came to the process of drafting Colby Parkinson in the fourth round. But I mean, I guess I'll give them Elton Robinson this year. Elton Robinson has looked good.
And DK Metcalf last year, obviously.
Yeah. There are a couple. Like, I mean, Elton Robinson, I think, is a more valuable player to this team than LJ Collier is right now.
Yeah.
So you seem skeptical about that, Kevin.
I mean,
there was some stats that showed him better than Chase Young.
LJ Collier is going to have some great approximate value because of all the snaps he's going to play.
but it is a concern that, you know, the talent that they've built on the roster, you know, they're having to rely too much. Like when you look at the offensive line, we're like, well, I guess they're going to need to bring Ethan Posick back because there's nothing else there. Right. And, you know, they got very little out of their tight ends from the second half of the season. It's like, well, you did spend a fourth round pick on a tight end who never played.
Well, he got hurt and missed all of training camp. Like, they didn't know that that was going to happen. Now, the Daryl Taylor re-injury was a bit more predictable given that he was injured at the time they took him. But I will give them a pass on Parkinson and hope that he's going to be more involved next year and that Will Dissly will, you know, actually have an offseason to practice football instead of rehabbing an injury, and that, you know, hopefully he can be more like what we saw in 2018 and 2019 when he was healthy than this season. So that would be very positive in terms of having more reliable options for Russ.
I can't say anything bad about draft picks from Stanford, so I'm recusing myself from the Parkinson.
but then if you want to look at the positives here, they don't have a lot of draft capital. They
the positives.
This is the positive. You know, the free agents that you're talking about, there are a lot of them, but and there are a lot of them that factor in starts. It's not DK Metcalf, it's not Tyler Lockett, it's not Russell Wilson, you know, it's not Bobby Wagner, it's not Jamal Adams, it's not Carlos Dunlap, right? Like, as far as impact players on the team, most of them are under contract, and there aren't a lot of places that you look at and you say that's a glaring need. So it's not one of those seasons where you always need draft capital, but it's not a season where you're like, they have to fix this thing completely, right? Like, they have no defensive linemen. The emergence of Elton Robinson was awesome. If Daryl Taylor contributes next year with Collier, with Dunlap, you're saying, hey, that might be a pretty good defensive line, plus Puna Ford, plus Jaron Reed, right? Like, that's a pretty good defensive line rotation if they're getting things out of those players. The linebackers, you know, they've spent a shit ton to have good linebacking core. We saw the emergence of DJ Reed. We know what the secondary is going to look like. We feel pretty good about Quandre Diggs and Jamal Adams back there if Shaquille comes back. You know, I think the line needs to be completed in a way. I don't think Mike Iupati should be the starter heading into next year. You know, we'd like to see another receiver in the mix, but otherwise, this is kind of the team. So I suppose the optimistic view would be if they can find a middle ground between the offense in the first half of the season, the defense in the second half of the season, if it looks roughly similar, you might even out to being a very good football team through the entire year.
We haven't talked about special teams at all here, but I want to say now that I can't jinx it, Jason Myers not missing a field goal all year. Pretty incredible. Like the Seahawks eventually got that one right, the money they spent for Jason Myers. I mean, who knows if that's sustainable in 2021, given how inconsistent field kicker accuracy is.
Who knows
is.
If not missing a field goal all year is sustainable in 2021?
I'm sorry, if above average accuracy is sustainable in 2021. But Jason Myers was awesome this season and deserved a shout out.
He was very good. Both him and Dixon were very good.
Yeah.
I also just want to say, I don't know where their third down percentage finished for the year, but the Seahawks had what?
You know where it finished.
Where did it rank in the NFL? Are you looking this up?
I think we both are in different places.
I'm attempting to. My own website's not looking. Oh, here it is. So I have an EPA per play on third down. I have the Seahawks at number 23, which is better than I expected. At third down conversions over expected given distance, I have them at number 16, which is again better than I expected, but worse than you would expect given how good their offense was otherwise.
Yes. It is shockingly poor given how good they were at passing.
They suffered some bad luck this year. You know, there was that piece.
I mean, I still remember there was a famous Football Outsiders projection many years ago. I think it was the Chargers. God, Breeze might even still been there. And it was like they were projected to leap up because they had been so much worse on third down than first and second down. And that was the first time we'd considered like, hey, that's this thing that's pretty random, but controls a lot of your success in football. So if you're bad on that one year, it's actually a good sign for the next.
There we go. Great sign. We can feel really good about this offense. You can always explain it away. I think a lot of it is randomness. And, you know, part of the other piece is I think a lot of what happened this season was kind of randomness. You know, the offense being bad for so long, you have to take out of it. But they did have some bad luck not getting a special teams touchdown. And despite having pretty good special teams, I mean, man, if DJ Reed breaks that play open yesterday and takes it to the house, it's just like so close. Not having a defensive touchdown for the entire season, right? Like, and I don't know where the penalties ranked, but like, man, they did not feel like they had the massive benefit of penalties too often, especially in the second half of the season. I mean, there was the play that Russ got pushed out of bounds yesterday where it's like this easily could have been roughing the passer and ended up not being called. So there are some ways to look at it as the Seahawks partially were just unlucky this season, and maybe that'll turn around.
Their EPA per play on rush attempts on third downs was second worst in the league, which is probably not what Pete Carroll wants in a football team.
I think we can agree on that, yes. All right, well, we've had the Seahawks here to fill these four rainy months during the midst of a pandemic. And now we got 8 months of off-season talk to try to sustain us until they're back again. Although I guess only 7 months, because there will probably be some form of a preseason in 2021, which will be a change from this year.
Looking forward to the draft preview where you have on Third Pelton brother, Zach Whitman, to talk about what the Seahawks should do with their second round pick and only their second round pick.
And then they don't do any of it.
Yeah, as is tradition.
And everybody gets extraordinarily mad at Zach for how negative he is.
Oh, well, first they're going to get mad at us on how extraordinarily negative we were here, I'm sure. So
I feel like I ended up being positive.
We found some silver linings.
Ben, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I wouldn't miss this. Hopefully one of these years, it'll be a happier one of these. But until then, always appreciate it.
Until then, save the day for the second Sunday in January. Thanks for listening.